You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
So welcome to another edition of Item 13. This week in the guest chair, I'm excited to have Edwina Morgan for so people can find you online. But we're going to call you Eddie. I remember meeting Eddie in London. How many years ago now is it?
I think it's been about 4 years ago. I mean, it's quite a while, isn't it?
Wow. It's been a long time. Yeah, we met in London. I don't even remember what the context was really, but I remember having followed Wachili for a long time and then being able to meet you. And we had lunch or dinner or something like that.
It was dinner. I had attended a conference and we met up and had, Pan-Asian, I think.
Oh yeah, probably, because then we probably talked about fusion and all of that,
which exactly.
we're going to get into today. Great. So for those that are not familiar with Wachili Leaf is one of London's leading boutique Afrofusion caterers, passionate about creating enjoyable and memorable experiences through food while setting new standards for quality and excellence. They do mouth-watering canapes, bowl food, themed supper clubs, and luxury banquets. If you haven't been on their Instagram page, I highly encourage you to go. Like, it's just a visual feast for the eyes. So excited to have you on the show today, Eddie.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. So I like to start with people sharing their stories. Like, what's your, you know, and for those that don't may not know you as well, if you could tell us a little bit about growing up in Ghana, if you did, and then your early memories of food or cooking experiences.
Oh, brilliant. God, where do I start? It all seems so far away. But for me, I think I always start from the food. And my grandmother really is my inspiration and has been for as long as I remember. And I associate my food or my love for food with my grandmother, because I lived with her to the very early years of my life. I think I went to Ghana when I was about 5, and I stayed with my grandmother for quite some time whilst my mum stayed in England to work. And I remember how, gosh, we spent most of our time in the kitchen. She had this really small makeshift kitchen just in front of our house. But she spent most of her time there because people loved what my grandma would cook. So they would often sort of pop by and say hello, knowing that she would have something for them. But she had this very small, the really interesting thing is that I remember is that she had this very small pot, but somehow she could feed about 10 people from whatever she cooked in that pot. It was just really magical. But I hadn't realized that by sitting with her, literally I was by her feet, I wouldn't go anywhere. My grandma never left any place or went anywhere without me. And I would sit right next to her in the kitchen just watching her. I hadn't realized that I was absorbing everything she was saying or doing. And even now, I still catch myself doing little things that my grandma used to do, oftentimes not realizing why I'm doing it. I'm just doing it because that's how I kind of remember her, or that's how she used to do things. And I now go to my mom and ask, oh, do you know why I used to call my grandma Ma, because obviously I was living with her for quite some time. I'll ask her, so what do you know why Ma used to do this? And then she would then explain, sort of give me some context. So my early memories of Ghana really is my grandmother, and it's the time that I spent with her, just in and outside the kitchen. But it's very interesting that whenever I think of Ghana, I always think of the food. I always think of my grandmother. I would often travel to the UK to visit my mom during the holidays. But when I came permanently to settle in the UK, I remember, I think I was about 11 or so, I would be the one cooking at home for my mum. She'd come home from work and I'd be the one cooking. I'd come back from school and I'd cook. So from a very young age, it was almost the expectation, because I had been the one who was sitting with my grandma. So people knew that the food would be great. So they would often sort of, the trend of visiting my mum, as people did in Ghana, for my grandmother, became a thing when I came to the UK as well, because I would often cook and my mum would have her friends over and we'll all sort of sit there reminiscing about my grandmother's cooking and how some of the things that I did were quite similar to what she did. So the continuity was actually quite nice.
Cool. So I can imagine. Well, one, I relate to it because I also remember cooking for my family. I feel like this was class six in Ghana, I would say. So I don't know what that was. 12, 13.
Yeah.
So I also did start to cook pretty, I guess in, from a global terms, it sounds pretty early, but in Ghanaian terms, it's probably it's pretty typical. Yes. I'm sure a lot of people don't know this, but you're trained as a lawyer, right? As a lawyer. So how did you go from... I'm sorry, go ahead, Shay.
No, I was just going to say, I think people often sort of are surprised when I told them that I trained as a lawyer, but I think maybe it might be a similar experience, but growing up, you always sort of have that one job that everyone sort of thinks that you are. I mean, it's you. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was about, I don't know, maybe I was quite young. I had an uncle, a group of us were sort of like kids, I remember this quite well, we're sitting in front of my grandma's house and an uncle came in and was like, oh, so what do you guys want to be when you grow up? And everyone was sort of saying different things. You say, I'll be a policeman, I'll be this, I'll be that. And then it came to, when it got to me, he said, oh, I know you're going to be a lawyer because you've always been a pocket lawyer. And for some reason, that just stuck with me. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was just really interesting. I felt like everything that I did from that time was to fulfill that expectation. So, it goes to the power of words, right? Like,
yeah.
He said that and everyone kind of assumed that that's it. That's all I want to be. So from that time, every time someone asked me what I wanted to be, I always said I'd be a lawyer. So when I finished school and I had to go to university, I did a law degree. And then after that, it just felt like a natural progression without even thinking of all the other things that I loved to do that I would want to explore. I felt kind of almost like the path had been laid out for me to be a lawyer. So then I went into that and then I actually became a lawyer and then actually realized that I loved to cook as well. So then I slowly built out a hobby, which turned out into a really, really fun job for me.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. So Wachi Leaf, I know, started in 2008, which, what is that, almost 15 years ago? That correctly. So what was the inspiration for you to start it? Like, can you share details of how you started, right? So you just shared that, you know, you went to school for law and then you started cooking as a hobby on the side. How did you go from, okay, I'm doing this as a hobby to now I'm actually getting paid to do it as a business?
Oh, wow. Gosh. It seems like really long time ago. So I have a cousin, Ekwa, who, gosh, she's really lovely. Like, we used to spend, this was when I was, I think I'd finished university. We used to spend a lot of time together, but we'd spend most of our time sort of cooking and doing different things. And I remember at some point we thought, oh, we need to do something with our cooking. We had different interests. And we loved to cook and we loved to do hair. At one point we're gonna own a beauty shop. And then we're like, that's really good at cooking. And a guy that I was dating around that time, basically just said, you guys really love to cook. You should do something with this. It's not even a joke, because everyone who tasted our food just thought it was really great. And he said, we should do something with it. So we lived in a place called Crouch End in London at that time. And there was a farmers market that runs every Sunday. So my cousin and I decided to start obviously selling our food at the farmers market just to see how it would fare. And before we did that, I mean, we kind of just thought about names and things. Then also we thought about the space. There wasn't really anyone else doing what we had in mind. There weren't many Ghanaian or African kind of food stalls around at that time in London that we knew of. I only knew one that I think was Jollof Pot around that time.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, it was. And I just thought, oh, that was really cool. I remember when they had a stall at Exmark Market, and I just thought, this is so great for Ghanaian food, and you'd often go there and there's like a really long queue and all of that. And I just thought, this is just wonderful. Ghanaian food is selling. People actually enjoy it. People from colleagues that I went to the store with thought it was amazing. And Eko and I knew that we could cook. And we thought, okay, there's nothing like that at Alexander Palace Farmers Market, so we should probably try that. So we came up with a name, and it started out as a joke. We came up with all sorts of names, and we just, oh, how about Wachili? Because we love Wachili. We're just obsessed with this. Why don't we just say Wachili? One, we had friends who would often sort of say Wachili, which sounded quite funny. Mm-hmm. And people who recognized and knew what it was, and it just seemed like the right name for what we're trying to do at that time. So we went to the farmers market and found out that every time we went there on a Sunday, our food sold out. Even before the farmers market closed. Oh, wow. We would often get there. It would open around, I think the market was open around 11, and by 1 o'clock, our food would be sold out, and we made a lot.
What were you making at this time?
We're making things like we're making jollof rice, we're frying plantain, but there's something magical about plantain, right? It's just the smell. Yes. The smell of plantain, oh my God, it's just, I will advise anyone who has a food stall fry your plantain on site. So that was the draw. It didn't matter who these people were, everyone was interested and was intrigued about this really lovely caramelized, they would often say pieces of banana, but then but it was a really good draw, and jollof was a hit. We made stews and black eyed beans stew. It was just amazing. And there would often be like really long queues. So, but then it got busier. So from the store, we kept having people asking, would you do our event for us? Would you do this? Would you do that? And we all had sort of our day jobs. We had other things to do as well. So it kind of made sense for us to rein it in a little bit. And at which point, I think my cousin had also had other things that she was doing at that time. So she decided not to carry on with the store. But then I thought, gosh, we've got something good going here. Yeah. I had just sort of, around that time, I'd just finished training. I was about to qualify, and I was thinking, this would probably be a good time to stop and focus on my career. But I loved the energy. I loved the instant gratification that you get from feeding people, from mm-hmm. sharing good food with people. You see from their faces instantly that either they enjoyed it or not. And it kind of just, I don't know, it opens people up. And
yeah.
I felt that connection. And it's something that I don't always guess in my day job. So I thought, I'm going to keep this. I'm going to keep this little slice of wonderful life and try and keep it alongside everything else that I was doing. So I didn't quit Watch a Leaf. I just thought, okay, I'll try and manage my time as a new lawyer around it. And that's how it started. So from then, I kind of just took charge of my calendar. I just said, okay, I will do events around my holidays, and I'll stop the farmers markets and then try and be a bit more selective and more creative with what I was putting out there.
That's incredible. Wow. And so it's interesting that I don't know why I'm sorry, go ahead. Were you going to say something else?
When I was coughing, I've got a bit of a cough.
Oh, yeah, no problem. That's fine. I was going to say that it didn't even occur to me. And I think it's interesting because people, you know how they say that success overnight is a 10-year journey or something like that. So for me, what I see, you know, on social and like all of the reviews that people share about, your food is, I've always thought that it was always Afrofusion, right? But, you know, you saying that you started out just with jollof and frying plantains on site at farmers markets. I'm curious how you landed on this idea of Afrofusion and how you define it for yourself, because it could go, you know, all sorts of different ways. But how did you land on the idea of like, let's take this a little bit further, let me push myself a little bit further in terms of creativity and then just including other cultures in this food that I'm making?
It's a really good question, and it's something I often sort of think about myself. But when we decided not to do the farmers market again, I think at that point we had realized that it wasn't just Ghanaians eating the food. We had people from different parts of the world. But the interesting thing was they were all trying to make connections with the food. So they would often sort of come, oh my God, this reminds me of something that I have back home, or something that I've tasted before. Oh, you've got beans, but this reminds me of something else. So people often like to make connections with what they already know, especially when they are encountering something that's very new. So if it's a cuisine they don't know, they'd often sort of try and understand the cuisine based on what their existing taste profile is. And I realized that very quickly that if we were to sort of get people to enjoy, more people to enjoy our food, then we have to present it in a way that almost sort of try to break the bridges between the different dishes, cuisines. And for me, that's what Afrofusion means, right? You kind of just bring in lots of different elements and different cuisines or inspirations to reinterpret something that is intrinsically sort of very African. So I draw a lot of my inspiration from my grandmother's cooking and from her recipes, but it doesn't stop there. I feel like food has to evolve. And for it to evolve, it means a lot of people need to sort of almost buy into it. But if you, there are certain things that I just feel, or certain ingredients that I feel, especially Ghanaian ingredients, that need to evolve as well. We currently have a certain way of preparing them, but they're also, these ingredients are also present in other parts of the world. So it's like bridging that gap and then making sure the ingredients are celebrated for what it is. So you'd have different variations of it. But my thing is that you can't just add, I always sort of say this to my friends, you can't just add soya spice to something and then just something that is not very Ghanaian or African and just say that's Afrofusion. I think there has to be a philosophy, or some sort of thinking behind it as to why you're doing that. And the way I approach it is that when I create something that is not it doesn't look very Ghanaian or very sort of African, at least one element of it has to be authentic or has to connect someone who's African to Africa. So for me, it's the taste. So I would present something and would look, maybe I'll make something like a jollof rice bowl, right? When you see the bowl itself, obviously it's encased in panko breadcrumbs, which is not very Ghanaian. But when you bite into it, the first bite should remind you of what jollof tastes like. It should transport you to somewhere. So I feel like with that little morsel, you're breaking down different cultures. You're bringing different cultures, different cooking techniques, but you still remain true to the core of what you're trying to do, which is African food or African cuisine. So it should, whatever you create and call Afrofusion, in my opinion, should connect back to the Afro, if you know what I mean. Yeah. It should be that
Let's
connection.
Make sure that we get the Afro.
There should be that. And I have so many sort of aspects of my experiences that I feel I'm not one dimensional. I have different roots and different experiences. I've traveled different parts of the world. So I bring that to my food, and that also adds to the Afrofusion. But I also always sort of think of new ways to bring to life what I've learned from my grandmother and from her recipes. Just put a bit of a spin on it, but then remain true to the taste and to the experience that you kind of have.
That's interesting, because I see you talk about the idea of Sankofa quite a bit. And for those that are listening that may not be as familiar, Sankofa is a Ghanaian concept, although some people may say African, but I know it from a Ghanaian context, which translates to essentially going back and picking up, you know, what you left behind, right? So, and in our traditional, I don't know how you'd even describe it, like you'll see it in Ajinkra symbols, where yeah. I'm trying to describe this for people who are listening. It's like a bird. If I remember correctly, the bird is looking back. Its feet are sort of facing forward, right? So like it's working forward with, you know, looking backwards. Anyway, this idea is, you know, as you're moving forward, it's important to also, you know, look back and pick up what you left behind. Exactly. And so I'm curious how, in thinking about Sankofa, how you, and friends, please, Google is your friend. I mean, I have described it accurately, but go look up what Sankofa is and what it means in the Ghanaian context. But I want to understand from you, Eddie, like how you connect this idea of Sankofa, and you've touched on it a little bit with bringing the idea of Sankofa to this idea of Afrofusion, right? And linking it back to our traditions, you know, our traditions.
Right. So for me, it's a philosophy that's sort of at the very core of what I do. And I chose that really because it reminds me of conversations that I had with my grandmother when I left Ghana. And every time I would sort of speak to her, she'd often sort of say things like, like, as in, just remember home, like, you're moving on, you're moving so fast, you're doing all these wonderful things, but, like, remember home. And that has stayed with me a lot, and it's translated in my style of cooking. I always have to have something in what I cook that reminds me of home, that will remind the person that's experiencing my food of home. So even though I'm sort of thinking, oh, it's so lovely to have all of these different techniques that I've absorbed from the different places that I've been to, or even cookery shows that I've watched, or peers that I've admired, I always have to link it back to home, because how do I move forward if I really don't know what's where my roots are? And it's just hearing my grandmother's voice every time I make something, I create something, I just think, so what's the point of it? And I feel like, as a chef or even a cook, when you're making something for someone else to enjoy, I feel like there has to be a point to it. And I think I made that point earlier, that I don't just cook for the sake of it. There has to be a point to what I'm doing. And for me, the point is showcasing African cuisine and bridging culinary sort of gaps between different ingredients from sort of different parts of the world, but also just remaining true to the roots as well. And it's quite difficult to do sometimes, especially when you're trying to just be out there with your menu, but then also wanting to rein it in, and then make sure that when someone experiences, they are transported to a place that they remember in Ghana. And if they haven't been to Ghana, at least something that would kind of almost hook them to want to go to Ghana, or to go to the part of Africa from which that ingredient or that dish is inspired by. So that's that's how I approach my cooking.
Yeah.
And my style of, my style of cooking is always having a hook or an anchor back home or my roots. So I can go as far as I want, but I make sure that I'm securely sort of rooted in obviously my grandmother's kitchen, but exploring as well.
I understand that's perfectly clear. So I thought a fun thing to do would be to go. I went on your IG page for those that are listening, it's at Wache Leaf on Instagram, and just picked a few like interesting things that I saw and want to talk through, like your inspiration for creating those particular recipes.
Oh gosh,
I mean, and you can say as much as later. We don't, because I have, let me see which ones I picked. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So there's 5 of them. So you don't have to go into like a big story, but I'm just really curious. I picked ones that they're pretty recent. And I wouldn't say they're all recent, but just really stood out to me as examples of things that you've done that are pretty out there.
Oh gosh.
And I'll start from sort of low hanging fruit and we'll work our way. We'll work our way up. So the first one is a huache and pulled beef brisket taquitos. So talk to me that.
Oh, that one. So another thing about me is, I'm not going to go into a long story, but I just have to put some context in this. So I don't have set menus. I don't do it because I just feel, for me, it's about storytelling, right? So whenever someone approaches me and is like, oh, I want you to help me with my event, or I always say, what's the story? What are you trying to tell? Like, what are you trying to say? And it would often sort of, we'll have a chat, and sometimes it'd be like, oh God, my partner or my friends and I have this in joke. This is, we love this, or we had an experience. Oh, a very interesting one. We had a client who got married in a really posh place. They had a really lovely food, and then after the event, they just realized they were still very hungry. They had this very lovely European 5-star food. And somehow they managed to find, they were in another country, they found somewhere that sold Ghanaian food and have them bring it to the really posh restaurant. And that's their little secret. They both of them, I mean, I guess as a couple, they know that evening they ate tilapia and bangku after they had eaten all the really stuff at their very posh wedding. So when I spoke to them, they were like, oh God, this is an in-joke. We want to bring in an element of that in the menu. So then we created a menu, but there was a little bit where there was something in the menu that only them knew about and found it funny, mm-hmm. and obviously ended up telling their friends about it. But mm-hmm. sort of bringing those experiences, so the menus are unique. And with this taquitos thing, the client loves Mexican food, but then they also wanted to bring in an element of Ghanaian cuisine. So I was like, say no more, we'll think of something else. And I was like, yes, I'm sure we can make something out of your favorite huache, and then also, and she was like, oh, okay, turn it into a canapé. So that was like a really nice challenge. So I thought I'll bring together those two sort of things that she and her husband sort of would enjoy. And I think the guests, I think it was a little bit divided, but they did it. The flavors were there. The thing is, once they tasted it, it's like, it's watching. So you're like, okay, I see what you're doing. Yeah. It's
just all okay. Right.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. So then the next one I have for you is Milo ice cream. This is interesting. Milo ice cream with whipped evaporated milk.
Oh yes,
and crushed cabin biscuits. I think this is interesting because I think it pulls together a lot of our sort of British section too, if you will, right?
Yes.
It reminds me of breakfast.
Yes.
With like a little bit of, you know, the British influence in terms of like the milk and tea and then
yes.
So tell me how your mind worked to do this.
Oh my gosh, that's actually my favorite. That was my favorite thing because it's my childhood favorite. And again, it's something my grandmother used to make for me. I don't know if you remember cabin biscuits.
Yeah.
That was my grandma's treat for me. When I was good, I would have, she'd make Milo, but then she'd use evaporated milk, lots of it. It was so rich. Mm-hmm. And I would have it with cabin biscuits. Literally, I just remember I'm literally transported to her doll. Like she had this doll that she often sort of sat in front, and me just sitting next to her, just enjoying my big cup of milk, which was so thick, very thick. I don't know why.
That's a fun memory. I like that.
It's a fun memory. So I was inspired to make, because like, oh my God, wouldn't this be amazing to serve at one of, we did a Mother's Day event, and the menu was actually an ode again to my grandmother. I'm going to say this ad nauseum. I just love that one. The menu was an ode to her and just things that she used to do. And if you read through the menu, you sort of see different, read through the story, you see the menu within the story. Mm-hmm. And we finished it with that particular dessert because it just reminds me so much of her and just how much I would always be rewarded for being a good little girl with my tea and my cabin biscuit and just my little seat next to her. So that was the inspiration.
That's so cool. And then the next one that I'm trying to think of. Yeah, this I think this is Or you tell me. I was kind of curious where this came from. So the next one that I saw that was interesting to me were crispy rice squares that were topped with corn beef stew and shit.
Oh, yes. That's also another favorite. I'm obsessed with Japanese food. Like, I'm inspired with Japanese food. I'm inspired by Japanese food, and I love it. I love to eat it. And I just sort of, this was something that I did at home because I had leftover rice, and I just thought, wouldn't it be amazing to turn this into a kind of place? And it was a hit at home. Like, it was just really nice. A good way to use my leftover rice, and it ended up on a client's menu as well, as their canapé. But it was inspired by something I saw. I'm a big fan of anime. I think I saw it in an anime. Someone had made something like that. And I was like, oh my god, this would be so amazing.
Cool. Yeah. And then staying in the Asian theme here, I also saw a steamed stuffed sweet plantain bun. So. And I thought that looked so good.
Yeah, that tasted really good. I had a client who didn't want us to fry anything. I do.
Oh.
But I love the sort of clients that I get, and I love the challenge. And I also love that I have the opportunity to pick and choose the sort of events that I want to do. Like, usually the ones that are quite hard that come and they're like, oh my god, I just want the whole gluten-free, I don't want anything fried. I love those sort of clients. So we had a client that didn't want anything fried, nothing with oil or anything in there, but then they loved plantain, they love red. So what do we do? So I just thought, why don't we do this? This would be amazing. Very little oil. I think they could have coconut oil, so that was kind of like the base. For my stewed red that went inside there.
Oh, so that's what was the stuffing, red essentially.
That was the stuffing. It was essentially red, but it was essentially red with coconut oil and coconut milk in there.
Oh my gosh.
It was quite decadent, like, and nice. Oh, but it was
all right. And then the last one here before we take a short break. This was interesting. So it was your take on like eba and palm nut soup or stew or sauce or soup, depending on which part of that. So I'm going to just try to describe it, and then I'll share a picture on Instagram when this comes out so people can also visually see this. So imagine like a bowl. Actually, I don't know if it was a regular bowl or if it was in one of our, anyway, let's say, imagine a bowl that has, that is covered, right? And on top of it, the cover of this bowl is, I'm using your words now, Eddie, a crispy yellow eba or gari crisp, as you called it, with a garden egg puree. And then underneath it, you have smoked king prawn and abengkwang, or like palm fruit sauce with bronze fennel and a truffle caviar. Talk to me about this.
Oh yes. Oh gosh. That dish. It was really wonderful. I loved making it. And so my thing is I'm just really playful with food, and I just feel like food. As I evolve in my journey as a cook, as a chef, I tend to sort of want to play, be a bit more playful with the food that I make to create experiences. And I just thought, wouldn't it be just a lovely experience if you have to break into your, like literally just break into your food? There's a pattern there. I think before that particular dish, there was something else that you had to break. I think I made something with isomalt where it was also another ice cream that you had to break. I just went to a phase where I just thought you have to really to get into your food. But I was just inspired by the fact that these were very traditional ingredients, and it was a very interesting and fun way to present them just making a more enjoyable experience. The flavors were there, which was the big deal for me, to make sure that whatever I did to with that dish, the flavors had to be there. If you broke the eba crisp and sort of dipped it into the abengkwang, which is the palm the palm fruit sauce, it would still taste this. It would taste like you're eating eba and palm fruit. It's just that the experience of the experience around it is just a bit different than you know, but the flavors are all there. And that was my challenge. And I feel like with especially feedback from the people that tried it, I kind of got that right. It was just that it was just really playful. And I must have been going through a phase where I just wanted to break things.
Yeah, I saw that and I was just like, man, like Eddie's mind. I don't know how it works. It's just mind blowing to me. All right. I think this is a good time to take a break. And then when we come back, I want us to talk about just what it's like to run a business, a catering business in particular, that's based on this Afrofusion concept. And then we'll talk a little bit about, you know, what you're planning to do next, the current services that you offer, and then we'll wrap up. So you're listening to Item 13, and we will be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome back. I now wanted to touch on like what it's like to run a catering business. Before we do that, let's talk about your business model first. So in terms of the services that you offer, you do immersive supper club experiences. So like you talked about, you do your Mother's Day experiences. Yeah. I know you do something for Valentine's Day. I've seen Love Rooted in an African Pot, I think it's what it's called. Yeah. Watch a weekend situation. So I wanted to talk a little bit about those experiences first. So how do you, as a lawyer, newly minted cook, get creating these dining experiences, right? So it's also creative, but it's a different thing, right? To cook in the kitchen, but then to also come out of that and create an experience from end to end for guests, right? And it's for seated or what have you. So how do you think about these supper club experiences? And outside of the ones I mentioned, if there's additional ones that you want to share with folks, that's fine. But like, how do you go about thinking about the experience that you want to create? Because I feel like from what I've seen, those also, and maybe that's where you also have some of your Sankofa, because every time I see menus of those or like the concepts, they really take me back to like growing up as a child. Do you want to talk a little bit about those experiences?
I think my favorite thing about what I do is actually the immersive dining experiences. It's just sort of because it allows me to be really creative and playful, as playful as I want, because you have control over the menu. You're essentially sort of asking people to come in. It's like a chef's table experience. You control the menu, you control the narrative, and also gives you the space to tell a story. And I love telling stories through food. I it's just one of the things I love to do. I love to write a menu like with a concept in mind, and then kind of make sure that everything that I do kind of matches up with the concept. Mm-hmm. So from the menu, from the decor, and from time to time, obviously, I'll work with people. There's a colleague of mine that I work with, Akosia from Creative Details. We kind of just met of the women and women just realized that we got it in terms of the sort of stories that we wanted to tell. So she's like really good with making the concepts, the really out there concepts that I have come to mind.
Yeah.
I do have some very out there concepts. We're developing an experience for Black History Month, and it's just really out there to the point where I'm just thinking, do I just put this out or just go to next year? But it's about being playful. It's about really giving people an experience. They walk into whatever space that we create, and I want them to feel fully immersed in the in the concept. So, for example, like the Love Bridge in African Poets, it's a movie from back in the day. I know my grandma used to watch it quite a lot. It was that, and I told you so. But I liked the story. It's actually not. It ends a bit sadly, but most of it is quite nice. It just sort of talks about and it's a love story in Cape Coast, by the coast. And it was really nice developing a menu around the story. And for our events, we tend to have things like videos of that movie showing around. Like,
oh, fun.
Yeah. So for the live one that we did actually before COVID, we had an art gallery that had the movie showing in the background, and there are points in the menu when you're enjoying the food that references bits of the movie. So like when you walk in, there was this shot that we had, which was I think an apetishi, and it was an apetishi. I forgot what it was that we had. Apetishi and sort of lime drink that we made, which is actually inspired from it. A piece in the movie where the guy who's obviously interested in this girl goes into a family to bring something, and there's some alcohol, and the girl's parents just said, "Oh, I thought he'd bring something respectable, not apetishi."
So, yeah, and for those that are listening, I may not be familiar, apetishi is a Ghanaian local spirit.
Yeah. But I thought it was really funny. So we kind of did a play on that. We served little shots of apetishi as a granita. It's quite nice. It's just that the creating those experiences that get people to laugh and to talk and to feel really part of a story that I'm trying to tell, or a story that's out there. And when we couldn't do it in person because of COVID, we did grazing boxes that actually had a link to the video on YouTube for people to watch, and the menu was also that's why I love doing these immersive dining experiences, because it allows me to be creative, allows me to really tell a story or something, perhaps something in my mind that I really want to convey, like this Black History Month thing that we're thinking about, which is drawing very close now. It's something that I want to, it's a story that's on my heart that I want to tell, and I've got a menu and everything that's around it, but it's like, are people ready to receive it? That sort of thing. So it's just those sorts of experiences that are thought provoking and also quite fun and playful, that hopefully when people attend, they kind of just feel like something's changed or they're inspired to do something about. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well. I hope you do it. I hope you put it out there. And for those in the US listening and the UK, Black History Month is in October. Yeah. That's great. So then, on the flip side, is your catering service, which I think is interesting, because then you are not allowed as much, I feel, to dictate sort of how you'd like to go, and so you're working in collaboration with your clients. Right? How? Tell me more about that experience, and like how. Yeah. Clients to develop a menu that stays true to what you're trying to do, but then also serves their needs.
Yeah. So I think I alluded to this earlier when I said I do actually have, I'm lucky enough to sort of have a situation where I pick and I'm able to pick and choose the sort of events that I want to be fully involved in. And by fully involved, it means working with my clients to come up with a menu that is uniquely theirs. Again, so they're being guided by me to tell their story. So I don't have a lot of control in sort of creating a menu that's totally out there, but it's their story in many forms. So I'll have clients who are just like, actually, I just want to keep it very traditional. But I want to keep it traditional in such a way that I can still have canapes, but maybe in smaller portion or served in another way. Or I can have clients where most of my clients actually fusion, where they have marrying into different cultures. So they want to bring elements of other cultures in, to kind of merge with Ghanaian cuisine. So it's quite interesting seeing people tell their stories through food and not necessarily sort of giving them a set menu and just saying, okay, choose from this. It's more, why don't we work together to come up with something that is uniquely yours so that after your wedding, you can actually keep your menu as yours, because it's not like what another client of mine is going to have. It's going to be totally different. We did a Malaysian and Ghanaian wedding, which was amazing. Just finding the congruence between the cuisines and actually presenting something that if a Malaysian tasted, it would be like, oh my gosh, that's so Malay. And then someone else from Ghana would say, oh my God, that's so Ghanaian. It was just really fantastic. Those challenges are what I love about the catering side of things, where kind of I take a backseat and kind of guide people to tell their stories through food.
Oh man, just saying all of that makes me miss, I feel like I missed the opportunity to have your food while I was in London, but but a day, a time will come, I'm sure. And then what I discovered recently, maybe you've always had this, but I didn't know, is that you also have a cookery school that you do with your mom.
I do, yes, I do.
Well, first of all, like, that's interesting, but then working with your mom to do it on Ghanaian food, I think it's like,
it's very polarizing at times. Sometimes I just have to take the seat back, and because I explain why things need to be a certain way, and she's like, no, we don't do it that way. No, and then it's like, I can see the students kind of looking at us like, you need to sort yourself out where we're going. But it's fun. It just makes it even more fun because it brings, obviously, her traditional knowledge, and she has context for everything. Mm-hmm. Why? And most of our, I guess, the people that we end up teaching come away with more than they bargained for. Often, sort of, because we'll be regaling them with stories as to why we do things, why grandmother's stories, or why in Ghana we do X, or why you don't serve things. I remember someone tried to give us something with the left hand, and it was just all a thing, the whole education as to why you don't give adults stuff with the left hand. So it's quite fun and interactive, and I get to spend a day with my mom just teaching people doing really lovely things together with others who are interested in food or interested in learning about different cultures.
And then that's great. Like, it's really been great to hear your journey to date. I knew some of the story, but it was good to hear, you know, sort of all of it come full circle. And as you think about beyond Black History Month, which is next month in October, how do you think about, you know, how you want to evolve Wachili, like the next 2 years, the next 5 years? What's sort of next for you as you think about what you want to do in the food space?
Yeah, I think I'm slowly finding my niche. I mean, it's been a long time, and I don't, obviously, because there are competing demands for my time, I don't necessarily sort of tend to advertise as much as I should probably do for the business. And it's been growing organically, but I feel like I'm finding my space where I belong, which is in telling stories through food. And I think my USP or our USP at the moment is just being able to take any story and then kind of reinterpreting that through food. It's something that I know is going to only evolve. So I see Wachili as sort of building on the whole immersive dining experience space, you know, creating one-off experiences, maybe finding a spot, like maybe a permanent spot at some point where people would come and have experiences created around them, around stories or concepts that they have, because we definitely have the I have the willingness to really try as much as possible, as much as I can, to turn anyone's story into sort of a food or a dining experience. So I think I'm going to focus a lot more around that, and then just doing interesting things on Instagram, maybe just creating
We always love to see it. So that I'm encouraged to hear. For those of us that are not in London and can't experience it, like,
experiencing it vicariously through Instagram is always it's always a pleasure.
Maybe one day I'll do a food tour.
I hope so. As we wind up here, before we transition to rapid fire, can you let people know where they can find you online, on social media, if they want to connect with us to learn more about you, your business, or if they're based in the UK, if they want to sign up for a cookery class or, you know, to cater their weddings, what have you?
Right. So we have a website, which pretty much has all our contacts there and talks about what we do. It's www.watchaleaf.co.uk, and we are very visible on Instagram. If you type at Watch a Leaf, you'll find, I don't think there's any other company called Watch a Leaf. You just find us. And I mean, my contact details are on our website as well.
Okay. So, great. And I will. Yeah, I will tag you and share the link in the show notes when the episode comes out. So we like to wrap up here with fun, rapid fire questions that you don't have to think too much about. Like, the first instinct answer that pops up for you, you can share. So first one is, what's the one ingredient you can't live without?
Oh, good.
I know, I think that's bad for you based on everything that you do.
Tomatoes.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Tomatoes. Okay. And then, would you rather lose your sense of smell or taste?
Oh, gosh. Taste.
Okay. And then, who would you rather meet, your ancestors or future descendants?
Oh, gosh. You said this was.
Did I make it sound too easy?
You did. Oh my gosh. Future descendants.
Okay. And then the last one, which was hopefully an easy one. What's your favorite or best Afrofusion canapé that you've ever made?
Repeat the question again. I didn't quite catch
your that. Favorite Afrofusion canapé that you made, that you've ever made.
Oh gosh,
it's like having to choose your favorite child.
Yeah, it is. Does it have to be a canapé?
Okay, no, I will take out the canapé piece. Your favorite dish ever that you ever created.
It's the dish you referenced, the breaking things one. That was my favorite. That was my favorite. So it's the Ember crisp with the palm nut.
Dab and coin sauce. Yeah, cool. Awesome. Well, I'm glad I picked your favorite dish.
Yay.
It has been such a pleasure. Like, you know, I followed your story for years now. I'm inspired by what you do and what you're contributing to this food space. And I thank you for sharing your time and your energy with me this afternoon.
Thank you. I'm so grateful. Thanks for having me on here.
Item 13 is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.